School Theater. Thursday and Saturday shows are at 7, with Sunday matinees at 2. Now back to Weekend Edition.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. In this hour, we have the latest on the ground in Chicago as the city braces for President Trump to potentially deploy the National Guard there.
We're here. We're not going away. No matter what generation, no matter what threat, no matter what president is in office, we're not going away.
And scientists are learning more about solar flares. Apparently, they're even hotter than we thought. Plus, we talk to the director of The Long Walk, a movie based on the classic Stephen King novel about a brutal contest that requires young men to walk or die. It's Sunday, September 7th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Hundreds of Iron Rangers packed into the Iron Trail Motors Event Center in Virginia on Wednesday. They were there for a chance to comment on the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's new wastewater permits for Keetac. Megan Buffington attended and has more.
The PCA had to open up additional space for the 400 miners, environmentalists, and politicians. The presentation, Q&A, and comments swam through the complex history of the state's wild rice sulfate standard and its enforcement, and what that means for Keetac Mine and the Iron Range now and into the future. Here's the simple version. Minnesota law limits sulfate to 10 parts per million in water to protect wild rice. That's even lower than the drinking water standard. For various reasons, that limit hasn't really been enforced in the 50 years it has existed. The PCA says Keetac has until April 2030 to comply with the limit. U.S. Steel asked for a variance, but the PCA denied it. The PCA used a lottery system to decide who got to comment at the meeting. About 40 people got to speak of the over 150 who signed up. If you had to split it, about 60% were Iron Rangers who opposed the PCA decision. Most expressed fear of the economic repercussions and questioned the basis of the standard. Chad Daniels has worked in the mines for almost 30 years.
This standard isn't right. At some point we'll get it right and we'll comply with it. It'll make sense. But are we going to put these companies and these jobs out of business and get rid of them? And it's too late at that point.
U.S. Steel estimates it will cost the mine hundreds of millions of dollars to meet the standard, which the PCA agrees with. And Keetac's only the first mine that will have to do so. It doesn't help that hundreds of miners are currently laid off and U.S. Steel is being sold. The other 40% of speakers were environmental and indigenous advocates who say the enforcement of the rule is long overdue. Mike Maleska is a retired miner from Hibbing.
The company doesn't want to pick up the tab. Instead, they want you to raise your voices to pressure the MPCA to eliminate the only water quality standard we have so they can continue to pollute, setting the stage for even worse desecration of our rivers and lakes for our kids to deal with.
The draft permit and variance decision are open for public comment through September 22nd. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
With a new school year here, roughly 150,000 Minnesota K-12 students are receiving special education services. Districts are mandated to craft learning plans for kids with disabilities, but for parents, requests can sometimes involve a maze of phone calls, documents, and meetings. State data show growth in families asking for support, like individualized education programs. The demand comes amid greater awareness of neurological disorders, including autism. Advocates say after a diagnosis, parents encounter a process where school staff want to ensure the child's needs meet certain criteria before an IEP is put in place. The Pacer Center's Beth James assists families in these situations.
That line is not super clear. And so that's what makes it really difficult because it's so highly individualized. However, a student does have to demonstrate educational need in order to be eligible for those special education services.
That means the school has to see evidence of the disability affecting a student's learning. If staff says the time isn't right for an IEP, parents have options, including an evaluation done by the school. If there's no resolution, they can seek a formal conference with the district and possible mediation facilitated by the state. PACER encourages parents to connect with an advocate, get everything in writing, and if successful, prepare to have their plan reviewed each year. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. The Minnesota Department of Transportation will host a public meeting as part of its corridor study along Highways 2 and 169 in Grand Rapids. The proposed alternative that will be discussed at the meeting Wednesday includes replacing several traffic signals with roundabouts and proposing a three-lane model for the corridor. The meeting will begin at 5 p.m. at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, morning show, and Phenology teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Protesters filled the streets of downtown Chicago for blocks last night, marching to oppose President Trump's repeated threats to send the National Guard and immigration officers into the city. On Saturday, several hours before the protests, Trump posted on social media about his plan, saying that the city is, quote, about to find out why it's called the Department of War, referring to his executive order Friday to rebrand the Department of Defense. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf is in Chicago and joins us now. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
So, Kat, you were at the protests. What did you hear from people there?
Yeah, tensions are certainly mounting here, and people at the protests were genuinely concerned that troops would soon be sent into the city. You know, Trump says the National Guard would be deployed to fight crime here. He called it a hellhole, even though police data shows that violent crime is down here in recent years. I talked to 33-year-old Kevin Ryan at the protest. He's a Chicago native and a Marine, and he was carrying a sign that said, "Veterans demand no troops on our streets." He says the National Guard is not law enforcement.
The military is not trained to police. It's a violation of federal law, and it's unconstitutional, and it's dangerous.
Other people there told me that they showed up because they were worried about American democracy, especially after they've seen that these threats from Trump are real. Trump has deployed National Guard troops in both L.A. and D.C. in recent months. In D.C., they've been there for about a month now, and people are protesting almost daily. Yesterday, there was one that drew very large crowds and marched toward the White House. And to clarify, there are no troops in Chicago yet, but Trump has made it clear it is something he set on doing. He just isn't saying when.
Trump isn't just threatening to send in the National Guard. He's also threatening increased deportation by ICE. What have you been hearing from people about that?
Yeah, I went to a neighborhood called Pilsen yesterday. It's a very traditionally Mexican neighborhood on the west side. They were having their annual Mexican Independence Day parade. Other neighborhoods in Chicago had postponed similar events in the past week. But in Pilsen, organizers decided to go ahead with it. The turnout was certainly lower than past years, but people I talked to told me that they felt it was important to come out on behalf of others who are scared to leave their homes right now. Here's Liliana Scales. She lives in the neighborhood.
We're here. We're not going away. No matter what generation, no matter what threat, no matter what president is in office, we're not going away.
There hasn't been an apparent surge here in immigration arrests this weekend, but the fear that people are feeling is very real. 27-year-old Andrea Soria talked to me at the parade. She teared up a bit, telling me about several undocumented members of her family who haven't left the house this week.
And for them to not be able to go out. And all this week, they've been relying on myself, you know, go get groceries, go check on this.
She said it's been really stressful.
We mentioned Trump's post on social media yesterday. How have local officials been responding?
Yeah, both Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker are strongly against Trump's plan. In response to Trump's post yesterday, Johnson posted that Trump wants to, quote, occupy our city and break our constitution, and urge Chicago residents to protect each other. Pritzker also took to social media. He wrote, quote, the president of the United States is threatening to go to war with an American city. This is not a joke. This is not normal.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Chicago. Thank you so much, Kat.
Thank you.
Ahead of next year's midterm elections, Vice President J.D. Vance has been making stops in key congressional districts to promote Republicans' recently passed mega bill. That included a visit to Wisconsin, where he told steelworkers better times are ahead. Yet, as Chuck Quernbach reports from La Crosse, Wisconsin, that's a political promise many in this area have heard before.
We love you all. Thank you all, Wisconsin. It's great to be here. We have a great-looking crowd here. Thank you all.
Late last month, Vice President Vance greeted workers at Mid-City Steel, a fabrication company in La Crosse, Wisconsin. The city is also part of a competitive congressional race for a seat currently held by GOP Representative Derek Van Orden. Vance, a Yale Law School graduate, continued with his long-standing efforts to show he can relate to blue-collar employees by speaking about his grandfather's history in the steel industry.
Let me take you back a little bit to where I grew up in Middletown, Ohio, southwestern Ohio, where my papaw, and the reason I love the welders in particular, is my papaw for 42 years was a union welder at a place called Armco Steel.
There's still a steel mill in Middletown, but many other U.S. plants have shut down in recent decades. Vance blames what he calls a generation of failed politicians and stupid decisions.
Well, now we have a different president with a different attitude.
He says a tax break for new equipment and other incentives in the recently passed GOP mega bill will help the steel industry and other U.S. manufacturers. Alex Bishop, a welder at Mid-City Steel, who attended Vance's event, says he generally supports him.
I voted for him and Trump, and they're doing some things that I don't agree with, but that's with every politician ever. But majority-wise, yeah, I think they're headed in the right direction.
Bishop calls the GOP-led legislation a net positive, especially when it comes to reducing taxes on overtime pay.
That's a big bonus on the end of my check, being I work about anywhere from 50 to 60 hours a week. That untaxed overtime at the end of the year is going to be real nice.
Ben Morrill, president of Wortman USA, an Illinois-based supplier to Mid-City Steel, also listened to the vice president. Morrill says certain parts of the GOP's bill will help his company expand and hire more people. But Morrill says for now the gains are partly at risk due to another big development affecting the steel industry. President Trump's expanded tariffs on imported steel.
So tariffs for us in particular and steel, yeah, it has driven up costs. Currently, we are importing the majority of our equipment and all the components with that. Having the investment in the United States, it has been a struggle so far this year.
Even with the added short-term costs, Morrill expressed optimism that increased tariffs could benefit the country in the long term. 3 hours away from La Crosse in Milwaukee, United Steelworkers members gather for an annual Labor Fest parade.
There has been disappointment before.
One participant, Jake Cole, a union staff rep, says tariffs are just one of the uncertainties. He says his tentativeness about the big, beautiful bill stems from failed past promises.
Sometimes when things sound too good to be true, they are met with strict criticism. The history of promises, the scope of the promises in general, just we are always skeptical about at what cost will these promises come.
Cole's union endorsed Trump's Democratic challenger Kamala Harris last year. Even so, Cole says he and other union members will try to fairly evaluate Trump's actions. Yet he says he's concerned about what he sees as Trump's attacks on the National Labor Relations Board, which is meant to investigate alleged unfair labor practices.
Frankly, they're dismantled. You know, that's almost like they're non-existent right now.
It may take more visits by Vice President Vance to steel industry plants to overcome the doubts before the midterm elections. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Solar flares are intense bursts of light and particles from the sun. And while they can pose hazards for things like satellites, they are also beautiful, dramatic, and incredibly hot. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on just how high the temperatures can get.
The sun is hot, no duh. But how hot is it? Alexander Russell is with the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He says different parts of the sun have different temperatures. The core is around 27 million degrees Fahrenheit. It's hotter than the surface, which is only around 10,000 degrees.
And then it actually starts to get hotter as you move out into the outer layer.
That outer layer is the ghostly ring you see during a total solar eclipse. It can be over 2 million degrees. What Russell wanted to understand was the temperature of solar flares. These flares erupt when a sudden release of magnetic energy sends particles shooting out. There's two kinds of particles, electrons and ions. Telescopes looking at flares can measure the temperature of the electrons.
And we've kind of just assumed, well, the ion temperature would be the same as the electron temperature.
The trouble is, that doesn't seem to be true, at least not according to recent computer simulations and measurements in near-Earth space. They say that actually, ions can get way hotter than electrons. So Russell and his colleagues did some calculations, and they now say that solar flares could be more than 6 times hotter than previously known. Over 100 million degrees Fahrenheit, maybe even up to 180 million.
Which is a crazy number.
They've published their analysis in astrophysical journal Letters. One person who was happy to see it is James Drake. He's a physicist at the University of Maryland. He and his research partners have long been studying how magnetic energy gets dumped into particles like electrons and ions. He says the difference between the two has been overlooked when it comes to solar flares.
We've been confronting the solar physicists, telling them that even though they've measured in a lot of detail what's going on with the electrons, they're missing something big.
He says adding this piece in should improve scientists' understanding of how solar flares and their associated phenomena actually work, which could help protect hardware like satellites and people like astronauts from these dangerous but awesome eruptions. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Edward Jones Financial Advisor, Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC. Long Lake Conservation Center near Palisade hosts Starapalooza Saturday, September 20th, beginning at 5 p.m. with indoor presentations. Stargazing begins at 8 with s'mores around the campfire. The event is held in conjunction with the Bell Museum's statewide Star Party. Ripple River Gallery south of Deerwood hosts the dual exhibit Reclaim Reframe now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5 and Sundays 11 to 4. Now back to Weekend Edition.
Giles Snyder with these headlines. South Korea says it has reached a deal with the Trump administration to bring home those South Korean workers who were detained at a Hyundai plant in Georgia. U.S. immigration agents raided the plant on Thursday and detained more than 450 workers, including around 300 South Korean nationals. Hawaii is keeping an eye on Hurricane Kiko. Forecasters expect Kiko to weaken, but warn that the storm could still bring the potential for flooding and gusty winds to the islands beginning on Tuesday. And following last night's drawing, two Powerball lottery players, one in Missouri and one in Texas, will share the second largest lottery jackpot in American history, worth an estimated $1.8 billion. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in three new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. From Dignity Memorial, for many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. In Colombia, a tiny spit of land jutting south gives the country its only access to the Amazon River. But now, drought and the shifting course of the river are leaving Colombia's lone Amazon port town high and dry. And as John Otis reports, that's led to a border dispute between Colombia and Peru.
The Colombian town of Leticia sits on the banks of the Amazon River, which forms the border with Peru. Leticia also lies next to Brazil, which is why this remote jungle region is known as the Triple Frontier. Tourists, riverboat pilots, and shoppers from all three countries come and go as they please. As the local saying goes, people here eat breakfast in Colombia, lunch in Peru, and have dinner in Brazil. But this good neighbor vibe is starting to go sour due to the meandering of the Amazon River. Drought, sedimentation, and natural shifts in the water flow are gradually pushing the river farther south into Peru and away from Colombia. A Colombian Navy study predicts that within 5 years, Leticia could be landlocked. That's a huge deal because there are no highways connecting this jungle town of 55,000 people to any other region of Colombia.
Entonces nosotros dependemos de un intercambio diario constante que hay entre los tres países para vivir. El río es la base esencial de lo que entra y sale.
Instead, says university professor Santiago Duque, the river is the town's lifeline, with boats providing transportation, as well as food and supplies from Peru and Brazil. As the river has receded, Leticia's cargo wharf has been extended several times to reach the river. But during dry season, it sits on dry land. As a result, cargo boats must be unloaded by hand.
Workers are carrying crates of beer, sacks of flour, bags of rice, and they have to walk about 100 yards up the muddy riverbank to waiting trucks. It's a really slow process.
Colombian officials largely ignored the problem, but that changed in July thanks to a dispute with Peru over a tiny Amazon River island. It's called Santa Rosa and lies a few hundred yards across the water from Leticia. Santa Rosa formed in the 1970s and has never been formally allocated to either country. About 3,000 Peruvians live there, yet Colombia also claims the island. When Peru suddenly upgraded Santa Rosa's status from village to town, giving it a larger government presence, Colombian President Gustavo Petro flew to Leticia to protest.
Colombia no reconoce la soberanía del Perú sobre la denominada Isla de Santa Rosa.
In a speech, Petro said, Colombia does not recognize Peruvian sovereignty over Santa Rosa.
De ninguna manera dejaré perder el río Amazonas a manos de Perú.
Then, in a bizarre stunt, Daniel Quintero, a Colombian presidential candidate, posted a video of himself sneaking onto Santa Rosa and raising a Colombian flag. Whipping up nationalist sentiment is nothing new for politicians. However, Santa Rosa would give Colombia greater access to the Amazon River. What's more, Colombians are tired of losing territory. The most infamous case is Panama, which used to be a Colombian province. Then, in 1903, the U.S. helped cook up a revolution so it could build the Panama Canal.
Papacita.
Colombia and Peru have often wrangled over their frontier and in 1932 fought a brief border war. Experts say both nations have legitimate claims to Santa Rosa and should settle things diplomatically. In the meantime, I set out for Santa Rosa to find out what people there think.
So we're motoring across the Amazon River in a boat. We've just left Colombian territory, and we can now see a huge red and white Peruvian flag flying over the island of Santa Rosa.
Indeed, folks here are proudly Peruvian. But it's not like they're spoiling for a fight. They often shop, send their kids to school, and get medical care in Leticia.
Nunca hubo problema. Somos como una hermanidad, tres fronteras.
We've never had problems with Colombia, says fisherwoman Flor Gomez. We are like brothers. In the town park, I ask Santa Rosa Mayor Max Ortiz about the dispute. He says it boils down to the ever-changing course of the Amazon River.
Con la naturaleza, nadie juega.
And he points out, you can't mess with Mother Nature. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Santa Rosa, Peru.
Bishop Michael Pham of the Archdiocese of San Diego came to this country as a child. His family fled Vietnam at a time when government agents would arrest people in their own homes without an obvious reason. Now, as he sees masked ICE agents in the U.S.,
it really triggered my image when I was 10 years old, seeing all of that playing out again.
That's why Bishop Pham goes to immigration courts to support those facing deportation.
In time like this, they're facing their own fear about their own family. They're so happy and grateful that we were there.
Bishop Michael Pham, later today on All Things Considered. Listen by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Stephen King's first novel, which he began as a college freshman in the late 60s and published under a pseudonym in 1979, is finally coming to theaters. The Long Walk is set in a dystopian America in which young men are forced to walk until only one survives. Mark Hamill plays the major who oversees this brutal test of endurance, which stems from a post-war decline that's fallen on the country.
We have the means to return to our former glory. Our problem now is an epidemic of laziness. You boys are the answer. The long walk is the answer.
Francis Lawrence directed the story for the screen, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Stephen King's story had 100 young men on the long walk. Your version has 50 participants. What other tweaks did you and screenwriter J.T. Molnar make to the story? And like, how much license did you feel since, you know, this is one of Stephen King's more celebrated works?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we had a lot of license. Stephen really sort of stays out of the process. I mean, he has to obviously approve everything. But I feel like JT, the screenwriter, and I knew what we wanted to focus on, which was primarily the camaraderie of the boys and the relationships. And, you know, we made some tweaks in terms of plot and in terms of some sort of backstories of some of the characters and things like that. We reduced the number of young men from 100 to 50, but that was primarily for sort of budget reasons. We also, you know, changed the speed with which the walkers are supposed to walk, which in the novella was 4 miles per hour, but now we all have treadmills and we know how fast 4 miles per hour is. So we reduced it to 3, but we made some tweaks, but you know, we did all that. And then there's this moment where you sort of cross your fingers and send the script off to Stephen King and hope he goes for it. And he loved everything that we had done with it. And we got to make the movie.
And my understanding is that is Stephen King said, like, one condition for this film being made was for the teenage characters to be shown being shot. What did you take away from what he meant by that demand?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, look, it's a brutal story and it's a brutal book. And what you have is this sort of brutal violence that's cut against and contrasted against this, you know, sometimes really intimate emotion and relationships, and you need both. And I think there's a tendency, especially in Hollywood now, to kind of water that stuff down, to be afraid, to pull back, to not have blood, to not have the violence, which is part of the story. It was written as an allegory for the Vietnam War at the time. And the violence and what people see and how it traumatizes them and how it affects them, you know, in those kinds of situations is a really important aspect. So if you suddenly are cutting away all the time or watering it down and not having that intensity and that brutality, it sort of castrates the story a bit. And I know that was important to me, and it was also important to Stephen King.
You mentioned this was an allegory for Vietnam and all the thousands of young soldiers being drafted into that war. We have a clip. There's a moment from where Ray and the other characters, and Ray is played by Cooper Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman's son. The other characters early on in the film, they put the war's influence in clear view.
I mean, even though only 50 of us get picked in the lottery, all of the boys in this country put in for it. I'm not exaggerating. Everybody puts in for it, even though it's not required. Because we're all so desperate. What does that tell you?
What?
Nobody signs up for this. Not really.
Obviously, Vietnam at this point is a long time ago, and young people today will not have much connection to it. But do you think that there are other connections that they could make?
100%. So I think one of the things that we tried to focus on in this adaptation, and one of the things I sort of gravitated toward, which is this sort of idea of desperation that you just heard about in that clip. And I think, you know, you look at the U.S. and you sort of think about the loss of the American dream, and right, and how hard it is to sort of earn a living that will put a roof over your head and food on your table. And it's not just in the U.S. It's kind of all around the world, this sort of sense of financial nihilism and desperation that people feel. And that's the reason that all these young men are joining this walk.
As a director, I guess, what was it like working with Cooper Hoffman, and how do you give, you know, actors kind of free rein to guide kind of the motivations of their characters?
Well, you know, it varies from person to person, obviously. I worked with his father on the Hunger Games series, so I knew Phil before I knew Cooper. I had not met Cooper when I was working with Phil. And so Cooper and I met first over Zoom about this, and he was really the only person that I knew for a fact before even meeting them that I wanted them to play one of the characters. And I knew I wanted him to play Ray Garrity. So we had a Zoom and we talked about the story, and he knew I had worked with his dad, and we talked about that a little bit. But we just talked about the character. And then over time, it started to become very, very clear to him and then me that there was this real sort of parallel with his own personal life. And that is definitely not something I would ever force upon any actor I work with, right? Like, that's their choice to sort of pull from their own life experiences and what they may be going through and how their reality may line up with a character they're playing. And for Cooper and with this role, there were certain parallels for him that he just made connections with and understood, and I think really added layers of, you know, emotional complexity that I'm not sure anybody else would have been able to bring just because of that kind of life experience.
You directed all but one of the Hunger Games films, including one coming out next year. That's also a dystopian reality, a deadly contest among young people. Was there something that you brought from that experience of filming those types of movies that you brought to this? And then how do you make this story kind of stand apart? You know, because people are going to bring the parallels.
I knew they would, because people like putting things in boxes, but there's such different stories to me. You know, even though that was also written as a war story, you know, the Suzanne Collins stories are, you know, also stories about war. And she always writes from themes, and they've become very different kinds of themes. You know, like the one I'm working on now is a very different kind of a story and about different kinds of loss. And the games are also very different, and the narratives are different, and the characters are so different. And the government systems are completely different. You know, the Long Walk for me was what I always loved about it, was really that in a competition where you think everybody would be at each other's throats, it's the opposite, that you have this camaraderie and this brotherhood and this support system that I just found so beautiful and so hopeful, and what made it singular.
That's Francis Lawrence. His movie, The Long Walk, opens in theaters this coming Friday. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Florida's oysters are in trouble. Overfishing and environmental factors are devastating the population there. And a group of scientists in the Sunshine State want you to learn about it by making bad data into good music for your ears.
I'm Dr. Heather O'Leary. I'm an associate professor at the University of South Florida in the Department of Anthropology.
O'Leary says she's a science ambassador.
I'm a water anthropologist. And so essentially, we ask the questions about what is it like to be human over space and time, but specifically through humans' fundamental relationships with their water.
Oysters are deeply connected to Northwest Florida's cultural history.
For many people, especially folks on the coast, they've grown up around oysters. Whether or not they are an intergenerational member of a family who has gone shucking and oystering as far back as a family can remember, or if they simply just enjoy oysters as a part of their seafood.
So it makes sense that O'Leary, who's based in St. Pete, Florida, would pay close attention to oysters as a water anthropologist. And to make her data more accessible to regular people, she got the students of anthropology and music at USF to translate the numbers to music. They came up with this jaunty tune. But why jazz?
When I say the word oysters to a lot of people, their brain goes in a couple of different directions. Some of them think about the roaring 20s, like living to excess with lots of different kinds of like oysters and champagne, the Great Gatsby.
Yeah, I'm afraid I haven't been a very good host on sport. You see, I'm Gatsby.
O'Leary says you can actually hear the numbers they worked with.
When people listen to the MIDI file, they can hear that there are changes in the pitch of the music. So the higher the price of oysters that are being brought in, the higher the notes. So you'll hear the melody change. And you can also hear some changes to the rhythm. The faster the rhythm goes, the more times people are going out for oyster trips.
And O'Leary wants your feedback.
I think my dream in creating this group of interdisciplinary collaborators and communities is essentially the fact that we don't want people to just listen. We want them to play with the data, see the patterns and hear the patterns in different ways than we have, and help us explain some of the anomalies in the data. Because when scientists can be good listeners to the community, then we're doing science right.
O'Leary says the composition is just a prototype right now. The USF Symphonic Band will perform the finished piece live early next year.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Learn more about the music and artists you hear on NPR and discover new music by visiting npr.org/music. There you can also watch a Tiny Desk concert or get an exclusive first listen of new music.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE on this Sunday morning. My name is Andrew Dezingle. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library welcome author Carrie J. Griffith Monday, September 8th at noon. He'll discuss his book, Rattlesnake Bluff, a Sam Rivers mystery. You may bring your own lunch or enjoy the light refreshments provided. The Pine River Bacchus Community Garden celebrates its 15th season with an open house and community meal Monday, September 8th from 3:30 to 6, with live music, games for kids, and prize drawings, located just west of the football field at Pine River Bacchus School. Northern Exposure to Lifelong Learning presents a program on New Zealand travel Wednesday, September 10th at 9:30 at the Begley Public Library. Doors open at 9.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. For the first time since it invaded Ukraine, Russia has struck the main government compound in Kyiv. Spokesperson from the cabinet offices today with helicopters dousing the flames. Ukraine says Russia launched more than 800 drones and 13 missiles at targets across the country. Protesters marched through the streets of downtown Chicago last night in response to President Trump's threats to send National Guard troops and immigration agents into the city. And at the Vatican today, Pope Leo declared the church's first millennial saint. Carlo Acutis was canonized during Mass in St. Peter's Square. Known as God's Influencer, Acutis died in 2006 at age 15. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The National Conservatism Conference convened here in Washington, bringing together an influential group of conservative political and religious leaders. This past week's speakers included Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, several U.S. senators, and senior Trump administration officials. But one of the most anticipated speakers at NatCon was a pastor from Idaho named Doug Wilson. Jack Jenkins of Religion News Service was at the conference all week, and he's here now to tell us more about it. Hi, Jack.
Hey.
So who is Pastor Doug Wilson, and why were people so eager to hear from him at this conservatism conference featuring all these big-name political speakers?
So Wilson is based out of Moscow, Idaho, where he leads Christ Church. He's been around for decades, and during that time, he slowly built his own Christian empire of sorts. But it's really over the past 5 years that he's become a national figure, in part because of his open embrace of Christian nationalism. He's very publicly called for a Christian America where women can't vote, and non-Christians and even liberal Christians are barred from holding office. And he's won some political allies. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth attends worship at two of the churches in Wilson's denomination.
So what did Wilson have to say?
Well, this was Wilson's second time speaking at NatCon, and he's a popular figure there. You could see him getting mobbed in the hallways by fans in the conference. And during his talk, he laid out his argument for why the U.S. should be a nation led by and for Christians, while also expressing his views on immigration.
It is simply a historical fact that America was deeply Christian and Protestant at the founding.
And he also said,
in the meantime, it is not xenophobic to object to the immigration policies of those who want to turn the Michigan-Ohio border into something that resembles the India-Pakistan border. That kind of nonsense from our utopian social engineers is actually the root of our current set of practical dilemmas.
And he's not limiting himself to this one annual conference.
That's right. So back in July, he established a sort of outpost of his Idaho church that meets just a few blocks from the U.S. Capitol. It's currently housed in a space rented from a right-wing think tank. And in the first sermon delivered there, one of Wilson's pastors declared, "Worship is warfare." He later praised the Department of Government Efficiency and described the U.S. as a fallen and lapsed nation that has drifted from its Christian roots. And I was there for that first service, and it was packed. And not only that, Secretary Hegseth was sitting right near the front, and he's been there multiple times since. And folks expect him to be back in the pews again this Sunday when Wilson himself is expected to preach.
back to the National Conservatism Conference. What else did you hear there?
There was a lot of opposition to immigration and a clear preference for white Americans with long family histories in the U.S. Other speakers and panelists criticized feminism and same-sex marriage. And there was also an interesting amount of animus directed at AI and big tech. But if there was a recurring theme, it was that many speakers made a point to denigrate Islam and Muslims. One speaker told me he believes Muslim immigration should be zero, and others insisted that Islam, as a religion, is just incompatible with American values. Still others mentioned the New York City mayoral campaign of Zoran Mamdani, a Muslim American, and Jack Posobiec, a right-wing influencer who was recently invited to travel with Hegseth on an international trip, had this to say.
As I stand here today, we are less than 10 years away from one of America's great cities being run by a Muhammad.
That was pretty typical rhetoric from this conference. And as I watched many sessions over the course of the week, there was a clear desire to move past points of friction in this conference over Israel and other topics, and instead to disparage a common enemy. And much of that ended up directed at Mamdani and Muslims in general.
That's Jack Jenkins of Religion News Service. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service. The pop star Somber is just 20, yet no stranger to heartbreak.
I definitely have experienced many times seeing, you know, the one I loved with someone else. And it's really the feeling you get when you see that and you still haven't moved on. It's like, it really, really does feel like suffering.
I took the train.
Shane Michael Boos gained a following on TikTok. Now he's Somber, S-O-M-B-R, and his melancholic take on pop is topping charts around the world. His debut album is called I Barely Know Her.
It's kind of talking about when you thought you knew someone so well, and then something happens in the relationship, you end up wondering if you even knew them at all.
Look at this as a breakup album or an album about unrequited love?
I don't really have a category to put it in. It's me kind of still learning what love and what heartbreak is, and this was the easiest way for me to express it.
You know, you grew up in New York City's Lower East Side. How did that shape you as the artist you are today? Or what impact do you think that's had on you?
It always felt like there were so many cultures that I was surrounded by. I would spend a lot of my childhood skateboarding in Chinatown. I would take the train to school and there would be buskers in the station that would be inspiring to me. And then also some of my favorite bands were active in New York and artists. And it also just felt super romantic, the Lower East Side. You get really good views of the city from down there. Places in the Lower East Side mean so much to me that I kind of have to write about them. And I've experienced so much in the Lower East Side. So you'll definitely hear it a few times on the record.
I see the girls with the low-rise jeans, but they do nothing to me, 'cause these are the streets where we used to be.
You attended LaGuardia High School in New York City. That's what Fame, that the famous movie is based on, that high school. You studied classical music there. Is there a through line between that part of your life and making, you know, what you call now like bedroom pop?
Yeah, LaGuardia was an amazing school. I was studying vocal and they classically trained us in Italian arias, French arias, German, among other languages. That's where I learned how to sing classically, and I learned mouth shapes. So it's definitely an education that helped me a lot for things like stamina when singing live or hitting certain notes, you know, the singing technique.
Some people have said that, like, the kind of, you know, harmonic stylizations in your music evoke the Beach Boys. Is this intentional, or are they some of your inspiration?
The Beach Boys, among many other bands, were the soundtrack to my childhood, because my dad, he would play all these bands on the record player when I was growing up. So it is a huge influence for me, and it's honestly just a great compliment that you'd even recognize that.
You also use distortion on these tracks. Why do that? What do you think it adds to the music?
Yeah, I definitely put a lot of distortion on my voice, like the vocals almost cutting through or trying to escape, and I like the amount of distortion on the vocal to reflect how emotional what I'm singing is about. It's a way for me to express emotions that I don't feel like I've fully expressed just from singing into a microphone. I want to push it even harder.
Your story of heartbreak that we kind of started off talking about, like, where does this album leave us? Have you reached some epiphany about love or heartbreak?
No, I don't think I figured it out, because I don't think I've been truly in love. It's just left me kind of wanting to live more and experience more now and kind of enter a new chapter, get new material to write about.
Well, now, will the her who you wrote a lot of the album about, will she be surprised that you've never been in love? Like, I thought he was in love with me.
No, I just don't know whether it was love or not. You know, I felt so obsessed and like I would be with this person for the rest of my life and I would do anything for this person. Once something like that ends, it really leaves you questioning, was it love? Maybe the fact that I don't know means that it wasn't.
About that. I have to think about it.
Me too. If it ended, it probably wasn't meant to be.
That's the music artist Somber talking about his new album, I Barely Know Her. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Larry McMurtry was the Pulitzer Prize winning author of Lonesome Dove. He won an Oscar for co-writing the screenplay for Brokeback Mountain, and he founded a bookstore in his hometown, Archer City, Texas. The store was eventually acquired by HGTV's Chip and Joanna Gaines, then sold and recently transformed into a literary center. The hope is that it can jumpstart a tourism economy in Archer City, centered on its favorite son. John Burnett has this story.
The lunch crowd at Mern's Cafe in Archer City.
You're very welcome, sweetie. Have a good day.
An evangelist is preaching on the TV in the corner. Chicken fried steak is the daily special on the menu. Proprietor Mern Wages remembers her famous customer, Larry McMurtry, in the years before he died in 2021.
I miss him being here. He sit right there at that booth. And he ordered a cheeseburger cut in half and a piece of cherry pie.
McMurtry was a celebrated novelist, screenwriter, and essayist of the Old West in contemporary Texas. Films adapted from his books, like Horsemen Pass By, The Last Picture Show, and Terms of Endearment, won 13 Oscars. The TV series Lonesome Dove won 7 Emmys. McMurtry was also a voracious book collector. His sprawling collection in this tiny town 2 hours northwest of Dallas became an international attraction. To Mern's delight, the bookstore reopened last spring, but only on weekends.
I hope it starts bringing a lot of tourists back to our little town. It was neat because people come from overseas, people came from all over the world to go to Larry's bookstore.
Two blocks down Center Street from Mern's Cafe sits the Larry McMurtry Literary Center, next to the Methodist Church and across the street from the Baptists. It is housed inside of his famous bookstore, Booked Up.
We're here inside Booked Up. This was a place that Larry, it was the center of his literary universe.
George Getchow, award-winning former journalist, educator, and now executive director of the Literary Center, stands reverently next to the floor-to-ceiling bookshelves.
He got married inside here. He directed in his will that his ashes be kept here forever and ever. He wrote in the morning, spent all of his time the rest of the day pricing books, curating books, writing comments in books, and cherishing these books. I've never known anyone who loved books as much as Larry McMurtry.
Time was McMurtry had four locations in town crammed with more than 400,000 books. After he died, along came Chip and Joanna Gaines of the Fixer Upper Magnolia Network. They bought his remaining collection so they could cherry pick books to stock the library in their new upscale hotel in Waco. Meanwhile, Getchow had been looking for a permanent home for his Archer City Writers Workshop. Last year, the Gaineses sold Booked Up to the Getchow Group, and it became the Larry McMurtry Literary Center.
The goal of the Literary Center is to preserve and perpetuate this book collection, this remarkable, immense book collection. This is really is a temple. It's a sacred place. We all feel that way.
It's also falling apart, like the ramshackle houses of the cowboys who populate McMurtry's books. Kathy Floyd, managing director of the center, says they need heating and air conditioning, new plumbing, and a new roof.
Water comes in at the ground level, and it seeps in and leaves puddles. The books that are on the bottom shelves have been damaged because it soaks up.
And we lost a number of books that were against that wall. Really very precious books that we put there because we had no other place to put them.
In much of his writing, McMurtry was rough on Archer City. Just watch the Last Picture Show. He portrayed the suffocating bleakness of small-town life and self-destructive cowboys and oilfield hands who burned out early. But then McMurtry came home. His ambitions were to turn his one-stoplight hometown into one of the world's great book centers. Jenny Schrader is volunteer coordinator at the Writers Center and an Archer City native. She says McMurtry himself cowboyed on the family ranch when he was growing up.
For Archer City itself, it means a lot that he was part of our town. He came from this ranching tradition that is still alive, very much alive today. And I think it shows the value in that tradition, and it also shows the value in an alternate route.
McMurtry took that alternate route. Books revealed a kaleidoscopic world beyond the ranch and celebrated the life of the mind. He would write them and collect them and treasure them his entire life. Today, the Larry McMurtry Literary Center aspires to keep his passion for books alive and promote a different kind of travel, literary tourism. For NPR News, I'm John Burnett in Archer City, Texas.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And from Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at BlandinFoundation.org. Stages of the Range Players hold auditions for the ice fishing play September 8th and 9th from 4:30 to 6:30 at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Virginia. The play was written by Minnesota storyteller Kevin Kling, and performance dates are